listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Good evening and welcome to Aloud at Central Library. A pleasure to see you here tonight for a discussion of Hollywood left and right. I have a distinguished panel with us here. I will be introducing them in a moment. I'm Louise Steinman, the curator for Aloud and the cultural programs director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which presents all of these free Aloud programs. So tonight we're going to discuss what is Hollywood's influence on American politics. Most Americans who pay attention to politics believe Hollywood's political influence in American life and culture is heavily weighted on the left. But in his terrific new book, Hollywood Left and Right, film historian Stephen J. Ross begs to differ. He believes the evidence shows that while the Hollywood left has had the political glitz, the Hollywood right sought, won, and exercised electoral power. So overall, which side was more adept at winning the hearts and minds of Americans? Was it the Hollywood right, with actors like Schwarzenegger's nearly seamless transition from action blockbusters to the governor's mansion? Or was it the Hollywood left, which followed Marlon Brando's observation that if actors can sell deodorant, they can sell ideas, especially when the moviegoer's political guard is down? So our panel tonight will continue and open up that conversation about the intersection of Hollywood and political activism. So our panel consists of Stephen J. Ross, who's an eminent film historian and professor of history at USC. He's written several books, including Working Class Hollywood, Silent Film and the Shaping of Class in America, which was an LA Times best book of 1998, and his new book, Hollywood Left and Right, How Movie Stars Shaped American Politics, received the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Science Film Scholars Award, the academic equivalent of an Oscar. But you don't have one for your mantle quite yet, right, Steve?
No.
Not yet. Okay. Mike Farrell, to Steve's left, is best known for his 8 years on MASH and 5 seasons on Providence. He's also a writer, director, and producer, and also a well-known human rights activist. He's traveled the world for the last 30 years as part of prominent international human rights and peace delegations. He's now working to abolish the death penalty in our state. He helped establish the California Committee of Human Rights Watch, and his opposition to the war in Iraq resulted in his co-founding Artists United to Win Without War. And he is the author of Just Call Me Mike, 2 books, including Just Call Me Mike, A Journey to Actor and Activist, and of Mule and Man. Roger L. Simon, on our panel, is the local author of 10 novels and 7 screenplays, including the prize-winning Moses Wine detective series and Enemies, A Love Story, for which he was nominated for an Academy Award. In 2009, he published his first nonfiction book, Blacklisting Myself, Memoir of a Hollywood Apostate in the Age of Terror, which was recently republished as Turning Right at Hollywood and Vine. It's a great title, The Perils of Coming Out Conservative in Hollywood. And our distinguished moderator tonight is Ella Taylor, a wonderful film critic, a book reviewer, and feature writer. She's the author of Primetime Families, Television Culture in Postwar America. She's written for Village Voice Media. I know you've read her for years in the Los Angeles Weekly, the LA Times, Elle Magazine, and many other publications. And she was a regular contributor to KPCC's LA Weekly film review show, Film Week. So please welcome our panel, and take it away, Ella, Hollywood left and right.
So let's actually take off from what Louise said, Steve. One of the, if not the most significant finding, then certainly one of the most significant findings of your book is that conservatives have always been a robust and, I think you argue in your book, perhaps more effective presence in Hollywood than the left, even though the popular perception of the left is as a bunch of commie-loving pinkos. You say that that's not the case.
Right. Well, Louise knows not 8 words. I can't get it under 800 words. So she asked me to read a paragraph where I lay out the thesis more elegantly, maybe, than I could offhand. And it talks about fears about, it talks about the FBI starting the investigation of radicals in Hollywood as early as 1918. J. Edgar Hoover was had his agents trailing people making radical films at the time. And such fears about radicalism in the movie industry reflect longstanding conventional wisdom that Hollywood has always been a bastion of the political left. Conventional wisdom, however, is wrong on two counts. First, Hollywood has a longer history of conservatism than liberalism. It was the Republican Party, not the Democratic Party, that established the first political beachhead in Hollywood. Second, and far more surprising, although the Hollywood left has been more numerous and visible, the Hollywood right, led by Louis B. Mayer, George Murphy, Ronald Reagan, Charlton Heston, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, has had a greater impact on American political life. The Hollywood left has been more effective in publicizing and raising funds for various causes. But if we ask who's done more to change the American government, the answer is the Hollywood right. The Hollywood left has the political glitz, but the Hollywood right sought, won, and exercised electoral power.
Roger, would you agree with that?
More or less. Yeah, I do, even though I look, when I say I'm on the right on economic matters, I'm not really on the right socially at all. As far as marriage and issues like that, I don't care where anybody marries. I only care who I marry. So I'm complete social liberal. Economic matters. But coming to your point, I think it's substantially true. But if you withdrew Ronald Reagan from the equation, I'm not sure it would be so true. Because the only one of those people who had real, I mean, Schwarzenegger was a second-rate governor. And achieved almost nothing.
Well, he was a second-rate actor.
Well,
so.
I would agree. No. But Reagan was a very successful president. You may agree or not agree. I think he did some great things. He tore down that wall. And you don't think that was a great thing? Well,
you'll have your moment.
Listen, inquiring minds may differ. But he did have tremendous impact. I don't think the other people had quite that. All I'm saying is I agree with you, but if you withdrew Reagan from that equation, it would feel different.
Well, that's why you have a historian here. What I would say, Ronald Reagan would not have been Ronald Reagan without Louis B. Mayer and George Murphy. And frankly, the biggest surprise for me doing the research was that everything Ronald Reagan did, George Murphy did earlier. He was the true pioneer in figuring out media, how to use media, particularly television. He perfected the Reagan strategy of going for discontent blue-collar Democrats in 64. And what Murphy learned, he learned from Louis B. Mayer. So there really is, Reagan was simply the best of all of them. There's no question about it. Ronald Reagan was the master performer. But his conversion to the right, which I talk about in the book, from those of you who may not know his past, is both George Murphy, who was our senator in 1964, and Reagan were liberal New Deal Democrats when they first entered Hollywood. And Murphy converted around 38 to Republican conservative. Reagan ended World War II, as he writes in his autobiography, as a bleeding heart liberal, and was, in fact, in many of the organizations that people were blacklisted for. But for a series of reasons, he slowly began a movement from liberal Democrat to liberal anti-communist Democrat to conservative anti-communist Republican. And it was, in part, his long-term friendship with Murphy, who they were very good social friends as well as political friends, that slowly changed them and pushed them that way. So I think you really do need to see a continuum, because the one thing they all have in common is they were far more effective than their Democratic counterparts in understanding how to reach a mass audience. And they understood that voters We're no different than movie audiences. You have to have a concept to sell, and you have to sell it well. And if you could reach them with your concept, you could win an election.
Let me ask you one question, follow up on that.
Sure.
I'm sorry. Because this has always interested me in this particular conundrum, because I noticed the same thing, not being an historian, but just being in film. I was thinking about it a lot, because back in the early 90s, I was teaching at Sundance, the Sundance Institute, so I met Robert Redford and spent time with him, and also Warren Beatty, who wasn't there, but I've known Beatty over the years. And these are two liberal Democrats who have always, people have said, well, when are they going to run for the Senate? And, of course, neither of them ever did, and I think it's highly unlikely either of them are ever going to do it now. But what do you think it is that stops them, other than they would take a pay deduction of astronomical amounts, from doing it?
Abuse. Warren Beatty said to me, I don't want to take the abuse. You know, when I'm a movie actor, I'm adored by and large.
That's pretty cowardly in a way, by saying that, because
it's honest. Do you want to take the abuse?
Well,
do you want to open your mouth and whatever you say is going to be twisted around? I mean, 34% of the American population doesn't approve of Michelle Obama. They don't know what they're talking about. How many of us know a Michelle Obama? And you're going to say you don't approve of, I mean, that kind of abuse. And you could take it on the right as well. It's not just the left.
You get it on both sides. But I think it's curious that those conservatives, for whatever reason, they got the abuse too. Everyone gets the abuse in politics. It's a horrible profession. I wouldn't go near it. But why so much? It's so completely so that these Republicans were willing to take the abuse and the other liberals didn't. I don't know why.
I think you have to have a burning passion in your gut. I think that you just have that passion for politics in your gut, and you're going to make it happen. And I will say, one of the things I argue in this book is I admire all 10 of these people, whether I agree with their politics or not. You want to talk about what a patriot is? A patriot is somebody who takes their belief out, whether it's for a war, against a war, for a left cause, for a right cause, and is willing to spend 10, 20, 30 years of their life fighting for that cause
and taking the abuse.
That's right. And that's somebody I admire, and that's what I found in writing this book. I did not want to write a book where one side, my own politics are certainly to the left, but to write a book where the left was good and the right was bad was a waste of anyone's reading it and a waste of my time writing it. And I wanted to write about 10 people who I actually would admire, again, whether I agreed with their politics or not, I admired their commitment to trying to make America a better place.
Apropos of abuse and maybe passion in their gut, but it's also, I think, a thick skin. Apropos of what Mike said about Schwarzenegger, I remember when he was first elected government and I saw him on TV going up to receive some accolade, and an admirer said to him, I hope you make as good a governor as you are an actor. And his response to that was, oh, don't be mean. Now, I don't think Warren Beatty could have carried that moment, and it may be one reason why Schwarzenegger has been so successful up to at least in achieving a political position where Beatty has retreated. One of the things that interests me, I mean, as a former European, is the definition of left and right, which is totally unique in America as a whole, and even more unique in Hollywood. I grew up in two countries where the word liberal connoted wishy-washy centrist. And then I arrived here and I found that the word liberal somehow puts you way far to the left of center. It seems to be a peculiarity of American politics, not the same in Europe or in the Middle East where I grew up. And what is your working definition of left and right in Hollywood? There are very few people who will identify as Marxists, for example. Even Michael Moore, who I spent a couple of days with when I wrote a cover story about him, really balked when I used the word socialism or the word, he certainly doesn't identify as a Marxist at all, cannily so, because I think that would alienate people. So the long shadow of of the Blacklist and the Hollywood 10 really hangs over.
Here, you know, this is interesting because I did identify as a Marxist. I'm certainly no longer. But when I was a student and later on, when I first came to Hollywood, because I was a member of the New Left at that point, I was quite publicly Marxist and I had no trouble getting work. In fact, quite the reverse.
In Hollywood?
In Hollywood. As a screenwriter, quite the reverse. It was fascinating. And people were fascinated with it. And this is a post-Blacklist period, of course. This is the 60s. It's late 60s, 68 through 72. At that point in my life, I was a very guilty leftist, and I had made a lot of money when I was a real young Hollywood screenwriter. Very lucky, purely lucky. And so I felt guilty about it, and I gave a lot of the money to the Panthers. So I was a financier of the Black Panther Breakfast Program when I was 25. And it had no effect negatively on my career at all. As a matter of fact, I would go into places like William Morris, and they thought it was really cool. And they would say, hey, Roger does that. So the whole gestalt had changed, and it had become trendy to do that.
And what year was this?
68, 69, 70, 71, that period. You know, when the Panthers were around in a heavy way, I was very naive. I didn't know that Huey was a drug dealer, although I knew him. I mean, I think this is, you know, I'm a case of that famous line of Churchill's, you know, attributed to Churchill, but not Churchill's, about being left in your 20s, you have no heart, and right in your 30s, you have no brain. If you're not right in your 30s, you have no brain.
It was addled from too much cigar smoke.
Yeah, well, it was also had to do with the fact that nobody lived past 40. But anyway.
Mike, I don't know, do you have anything to say about that? I mean, you've spent many years on the Hollywood left. How would you identify it?
I don't. I think that it's pretty much a creature of those people who observe rather than those people who participate. But I would take a couple of issue with a couple of things that have been said. I don't disagree that the right in Hollywood has been more effective electorally. But I would suspect that if you want to make that division, the left in Hollywood has been more effective socially in terms of having an effect on the culture. And I think that's far more, personally, I think that's far more significant than, although the wreck that the right has made of our nation argues perhaps that's not so correct. Mm-hmm. I would argue as well, let me say that I think you succeeded admirably in making an even-handed book about the left and the right without favoring or disfavoring one side or the other, which I thought was really quite impressive. I disagree with, I think, both of you about Ronald Reagan. No question that he was a terribly effective. His presidency was terribly effective. But I think his presidency was more the product of General Electric and Lee Atwater and Ed Nofziger and the people who were behind him and around him and telling him what to say, do, and think than he was as a thinker and or a mover in the political world.
You know, I used to think that too, but I changed my mind when I read his diaries. Have you read them?
I have not.
Interesting.
No,
I mean, he actually thought about it himself. He wasn't completely a puppet.
I wouldn't say completely, but I think he was
his diaries are rather well written. I mean, most of our politicians can't write at all. It's rather surprising, actually.
Well, I would also disagree with you a little bit on that, Mike. I mean, I'm no fan of Ronald Reagan politically, but in the course of writing this, I came to I came disabused of the idea he was just a puppet. Because I talked to people who worked on his campaign, who were part of his inner circle, very early on in 64. And what they said is Reagan would sit down and they would tell him, he would meet with his group and the speech writers, and he would tell them what he wanted in a speech. And they would then write a draft of the speech, and he would come back and edit it very carefully. And he would often go out and speak without notes, because one thing I discovered, he had a photographic memory. So it's one of the reasons he could not flub his lines when he rarely ever had to do a second shoot. But I had a graduate student years ago, before some of the new Reagan books came out, went down to the Reagan Library and did a research paper on his Star Wars speech. And what he discovered is Reagan, he went through the various drafts and just found Reagan's handwriting over everything. This was a speech he totally, he set out to his writers. When it came back, he totally rewrote everything in his own handwriting. So he's no Mensa, but no. He understood how to take, the line I have here is, he was not the intellectual leader. The intellectual leader of the conservative movement in 64 through 68 would have been both Barry Goldwater and William Buckley. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what Reagan did, people would not vote for Barry Goldwater because he was a scary figure. I look out over the audience, and I think some of you remember the 1964 Daisy commercial.
Sure.
The little child, pulling the leaves off the daisy, and then the atomic bomb going off, and then basically saying, do you want Barry Goldwater as your president? Ronald Reagan's greatest contribution is by making conservatism palatable, he made a conservative revolution possible. And he had ideas.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but I don't think, as you've granted, I don't think he was the intellectual genius that people suggest he is.
And no, because he was also a pragmatist.
Well, but I think further, he was a true believer in a sense of a kind of fearsome approach to the world that I think has been very destructive. And that, to me, doesn't argue for a great intellectual breadth or depth. I had occasion to be in Central America a number of times during the Reagan administration when there was a very clearly a kind of anti-communist veil that was laid over what was clearly a humane and humanitarian, well, humanitarian is the wrong word, but a civil war. Not at all based on kind of communism versus democracy, but really based on people's need to have a life that was meaningful in the face of horrific oppression. And Reagan and his administration continued to perceive it in this hideously black and white manner that justified all kinds of human rights violations. And I remember coming back after he made his incredible statements about the, in the case of the anti-revolutionary forces in Nicaragua being equal to the founding fathers of this country. And I had the occasion to have lunch with his daughter and said to her that, look, what your father is saying is simply not true. And either my concern is that either he doesn't understand that it's not true and continues to bleat this stuff because he's being told to say it, or he is a liar. And she said he's surrounded by people who have a very strict and very thick ideological perspective, and they keep him very well hemmed in that regard. And I found that to be very sad. It's, I guess, not unusual with our leaders to be hemmed in and be protected from experiencing reality. But I found that to be not only very sad, but very destructive of the lives of hundreds of thousands of people in the Central America alone.
Both of you, in one way or other, have articulated, Steve, in your book, you've said something very similar to Mike in the sense that the right has been very successful at getting candidates elected, and I think Roger nodded his agreement with that, whereas the left has had much more of an impact on the culture. Can you be a bit more specific about the impact? I mean, in what areas are we talking about?
Well, I don't want to suggest the impact has all been positive, left or right. The American culture has been spread throughout the world as a result of our explosion of motion pictures and television and what have you. But I think I'm with Clarence Darrow, who said that sympathy is the child of imagination. And I think people with imagination are capable of walking in someone else's shoes. And as a result of that, there is a tendency to, and I see it more on the left, perhaps it's on the right as well, to be open to others, to be aware of other points of view, to be respectful of other points of view. And I think that has permeated to some significant degree the stories that have come out of the motion picture and television industries. Before special effects and bombing and killing and raping and murdering became the story of the day. So today, I'm not sure that's the case, but I still think that people respond to the kind of human perspective that is put out in much of the work that some people would consider the left, Hollywood, liberal sort of message.
But I think that the left-right polarity, which on a mainstream level has been reflected in the difference between a Democrat and a Republican, is somewhat up for grabs right now. The whole picture of what counts as left and right is changing very much. You've got Clint Eastwood, who just said that he was against Proposition 8 and people should be able to marry whoever they damn well please, and he's a Republican.
Well, you know, Eastwood is something of a libertarian, as am I. I mean, we think that people, libertarians typically think that the government has no business in the bedroom whatsoever. I don't, you know, on any grounds.
Or in owning national parks.
So, yeah, libertarians are pretty extreme in some way. But, you know, on the other hand, guys like Eastwood really protect nature. So it's things are not quite as simple. I agree with you that I was a schoolboy leftist of the extreme sort, and when I gave it up, I didn't adopt anything else because I think that ideological ideas are a form of blindness, and ideology blinds us. I mean, I loved ideology. I grew up in the generation of '68 where Marcuse was God. And I have to say, I read Marcuse now and I go, yeah. I mean, it's just limits you to me. I mean, I look around this audience and I see a lot of faces. I used to live in Echo Park and I was really super left, And I see faces in here look very left. I know the world. I'll tell you something. I feel better now. And I'll tell you why I feel better. I know people are not going to like hearing this. Freedom from ideology is freedom to see for me. Sometimes the left is right and sometimes the right is right. That's a very weird thing to have to think, but it's absolutely true to me.
Does it suggest that the right is free of ideology?
No, I'm saying no, not at all. I'm saying freedom from ideology is
This makes me bristle.
Okay.
Ooh, do bristle.
I'm the same now as I was in 1968. I was a freshman at Columbia in 1967, 68, when the Columbia Uprising happened. I was very confused. I always studied ideology, but I was never an ideologue, and that's what you're talking about, Roger. People who are ideologues are fools, whether you're ideologue on left or the right. And there's no need to change if you're consistent in studying and trying to understand the world as it is, not how it ought to be. And you can then go from there and talk about how you want to change things. But it makes me bristle when I hear people say, well, when I was young and foolish, I was on the left. And now I'm old and conservative and much smarter on the right. You were a fool then, and maybe you're a fool now. I don't know.
I welcome what you said. I think that's possibly true. But I don't, as I said, I don't really feel ideologically akin to the right either.
What you described yourself as, you are a 1968 New York liberal Republican. Keating, Javits, Rockefeller, Brooks up in Massachusetts.
Irving Howe.
Those guys would no longer be Republicans, though. They would be too far to the left to be in today's Republican Party.
Possibly, yeah.
Not possibly. Tell me any liberal Republican from 1968 who's in the party now.
But as I said, free. But I'm trying to be free of all those things. So it's I don't. When I'm happiest, when I'm clearest, I try. As she said, what I found interesting what Elle said is when she came, and a lot of Europeans have said this to me, when they come to this country, they get very confused by the split here. And I think that part of the reason is that the split here is even more rigid than in Europe.
Well, it's also a creature of the media in significant part, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, totally created by the media and reinforced by the media.
Right.
And no question.
Yeah.
You know, to get back also to your question, Ella, one of the questions my colleagues were asking me early on in the book, which is a critical question, why is so much of Hollywood liberal? Why has it always been liberal? And even though I can argue that if in terms of seizing state power, of trying to understand, you know, why Republicans go to state power, they do. They have been much more successful. But we're talking about still small numbers. The vast majority of Hollywood is liberal. And I think the key is not liberal as a political term. I think the key, what you were describing, Mike, is empathy. That if you are going to be an actor or a writer, you need to be able to understand, as you said, to stand in someone else's shoes. Mm-hmm. You have to understand a character who is not like you. You have to be able to make them empathetic. It's one of the reasons Edward G. Robinson was once asked if he would ever play Hitler in a movie, and he said no, because I would have to find something about him to make him human and to make an audience feel some empathy for him, and I don't want to do that for him. I simply don't want to do it. And so I think if you have a sense of empathy, and think about how many actors, by and large, come from poor backgrounds, have to work their way up, have a hard struggle, that you feel that empathetic, and that empathy, that human spirit, leads you into a kind of political liberalism where, you know, you can see both sides. The world isn't black and white. It's kind of gray. So
well,
you're not a Marxist
you
and you're not a radical right winger.
All right. Let me ask you a question about that. Now, here's an interesting example of a recent film that was quite successful, which is The Blind Side. Well, it was last year, I think. Anyway, there's a movie that was regarded by critics who observed these things, not good critics, rather than, you know, people just sort of, or reviewers, let's say, as a movie that was, in some senses, socially conservative. It had a kind of a religious feel and base to it. But there's no question that it was a film filled with empathy, I thought. And I found it quite moving. So I don't think that empathy is so exclusively a left-side phenomenon. It can come from other things. I mean, if you examine that movie, I don't know what you felt about it. I didn't love it. I thought it was a good movie. But it was clearly a different kind of empathy. But there was, I'm sure you would agree, there was empathy in that movie.
Sure, sure. There was also cross-racial relationships, which are not considered conservative. I thought it was a television movie that was made as a feature because it had a star called Sandra Bullock in it.
Right. Well, that's a... that's a point of size and also legitimate. But I'm asking a different question from that. Mm-hmm. I mean, didn't you? That's a very kind of religious themed kind of Christian film. I'm not a Christian, but that is a Christian film in its basis. And I think it is empathy coming from the other direction. If you don't see that, I don't know.
I'm not sure I disagree if you want to analyze it that way. The point is that it's not necessary, it seems to me, to parse things as either left or right, these things as either liberal or conservative values. Humanity, humane values, humane treatment of other people, understanding, sympathy, empathy, the kinds of things that make us, recognition of the kinds of things that make us human and make the others with whom we interact human. It seems to me, is the thing that ought to be championed, whether it's liberal, conservative, or whatever.
But couldn't you read that film both ways? I mean, that was the interesting thing about The Blind Side, in my view, is that, you know, a lot of people on the left thought it was an awful film because it was yet another white person saving yet another black person. And I count myself pretty well to the left, did not agree, because A, it happened to be true. It was based on a real story. And I thought it was a very well-told story that was as respectful to both sides. So, yes, it in some ways it's a non-ideological film made by a filmmaker who was trying to be very concrete about the way the world works. But a lot of people really disapproved of it in print, a lot of critics.
Yeah, but you know, that's those are the people that keep wanting to fit people into slots, into, you know, into categories. And I think that's what keeps dividing us, which is the thing that I find so offensive about these kinds of, not this, but these kinds of debates and divisions.
Can we talk a little bit about actors while we're with
sure.
that issue? Because really what defines, I suppose, Hollywood left and right is the issue of celebrity. And it's often said that politics is show business for ugly people. But not in our town, right? That politics is show business with real lookers. And Frank Bruni wrote an op-ed in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago in which he basically said that the Hollywood stars should not be going down to Occupy LA or Occupy New York or Occupy Wall Street because they're too damn rich and too connected, you know, too hooked into the corporations and too good looking to really do the movement any good.
Well, and that's just utter nonsense.
Okay.
Utter nonsense.
A lot of people wrote in to say so.
Well,
but
good,
can you
yeah.
say why?
Well, certainly. Well, the first is that the people in Occupy Wall Street or Los Angeles or anybody else would embrace them and say, thank you for coming and
right.
showing us that you care.
That,
and
didn't
that,
happen to, that didn't happen to Michael Moore. Did you see the film clip of that? Michael Moore was run out of the...
Not run out of Oakland.
No, the Occupy Wall Street. I'll send you the clip. It's quite interesting because they were wanting to know, because he's reputed to have an estate of $50 million, mm-hmm. What he did with his $50 million, and he ran off. It's a video of it. It's fascinating because, you know, there is a level on which the hypocrisy quotient starts to reach a certain level and bubble. I mean... I had personal experience of Moore, because I was an official of the Writers Guild, very union-oriented in those days, and still am in that regard. And Moore didn't want to pay union wages to his writers, and he was very anti-union on his for his TV show. I mean, this is a well-known thing; it's even been written about in the New Yorker. So he's not a consistent man. And when he came down to the Occupy movement, it was all over the internet. The video of him being run out of there. It was fascinating. And, you know, this is a guy who's made a fortune, a real fortune, $50 million, off of a kind of pose, of a kind of left-wing pose, rather than, I think, real. That's one of the things that backed me off being a typical leftist after seeing years of that in Hollywood. I mean, it's very prevalent.
We're talking about apples and oranges here. You can have individuals that nobody wants there. But the main point of the Bruni piece was that if you are a famous, wealthy celebrity, you have given up your citizenship. You have given up your right to talk about democracy. You've given up your right to go into any group and talk about your solidarity with them, whether, again, conservative or liberal. That's what was so offensive about it, that just because they're celebrities, because they're stars, and because they're wealthy, they have no right to go down there. It was a ridiculous piece
of... No, I would agree with you about that. I think Moore is... Not Apple. He's an exceptional case. He's a strange promoter, and then when you start to feel a dishonesty quotient going on, that makes you go, wait a minute.
In the bottom line, what Bruni is being insincere about, the bottom line from the 1920s on, when celebrities started getting involved in elections and endorsing candidates, the main thing that celebrities do is they bring attention to issues. That an issue that might not have gotten the press gets the press. A candidate who might not have gotten attention get attention because celebrity A or B is with them. And to me, that's got to be good for democracy, because that means you're paying more attention to what's going on. And maybe if you're paying attention to what's going on, you'll actually read a little bit about what's going on, educate yourself about what's going on, and if you can educate yourself about what's going on, you can be an informed voter and make an informed decision. And I believe that if this country made informed decisions and informed votes, not like voting on In God We Trust in a disgusting vote in the House of Representatives yesterday, where we're just pandering, that's not an educated vote. If we make educated voting, and if celebrities help, get people to pay attention, more power to them. That's
well,
what I say.
There are celebrities and celebrities, right? There are those that you describe in your book who have done a great deal of homework and do a great deal of behind-the-scenes work. And there are others who, one way or another, are burnishing their images. I mean, the unfortunate Hillary Swank affair, where she went.
I mean, there is an occupation in Hollywood. I don't know how prevalent it is, but I know it exists, of people who make a living advising celebrities on where to give their money.
Yes.
Now, that's something, I mean, that's inherently in contradiction to what you're saying, because it says automatically that the celebrity doesn't have the brains and the attention span, him or herself, to figure that out.
No, they don't have the commitment.
That's really what it is. Or the commitment.
Or the time. There are some people who are working very hard
and are committed
to the kinds of work they're doing and understand a certain level of political sophistication but don't have the depth of understanding about which issue is being dealt with most positively and most progressively and most successfully by which organization or which individual is the one that is the most representative of the point of view that you would want to support. So I think it's unfair to lump celebrities into these categories of, you know, thoughtless people who are, when they become successful, are incapable of thought and demonstrate
their incapacity for thought.
Some are like that.
So are some plumbers. Yes, of course. That occupation is a symptom of essentially buying your activism as opposed to as what you did, earning it. I mean, that's a very different thing. And I would distrust someone who advocates a cause because, you know, he paid an advisor that would be a good cause for him, for his image.
I mean, I would agree with you only if he or she accepts the word of the advisor without checking into it, her or himself. And I think that's the step that you're suggesting doesn't exist, and I'm suggesting just the reverse. I think that there are some very, you know, we have a business out here that fortunately or unfortunately, it makes people millions and millions of dollars, in some instances in a relatively short time. And these are people, quite often, who aren't either equipped to or understand the best way for themselves to make use both politically and socially and personally of that money. So if they want to take the benefit of a talented person who says, you know what, here's what I would suggest you look into, and do that. If they look into it, then God bless them. If they just simply say, as I think you're suggesting, that whatever their agent or advisor tells them to do, that that's what they're going to do, well, then that's some sort of puppetry that's not worth being paid attention to. But we have people in the business who are really good, decent, thoughtful people. We have people in the business who are really creeps. We have people in the business who are very successful based on their talent and energy and commitment. We have people who are in the business who are tremendously successful based on pure luck. It troubles me when people make these grand generalizations about celebrities and what they do and what they don't do and what they should do and what they shouldn't do. You know, they're people just like everybody else.
Right, they're people with a lot more exposure than most other people. And I know that, in your book, Steve, you have a wonderful quote from Tom Hayden, who was married to Jane Fonda, and to some degree her mentor, who worried out loud that when people attach themselves to celebrities, you are getting them as fans rather than as citizens. So he seemed to be arguing against celebrity.
No, he was arguing both ways. He was in a conundrum because we were talking about, is celebrity politics ultimately good or bad for democracy? Because that's really the question we want to be getting at here, not left and right. And I agree. Those distinctions have created more trouble than they've created hope and change. Instead, we ask, what can we do to improve democracy in America? And, you know, I asked him, so, you know, you've been married to a celebrity. In the end, do you think celebrity helps or hinders democracy? And he said, it cuts both ways. He said, on one hand, when Jane and I would go out on the road with the Committee for Economic Democracy, CED, that was active here in the very late 70s, early 80s, we would bring the, you know, a lot of the Brat Pack, then the Brat Pack would come on the road with us, and we would get 20, 30, 40,000 people, and we would get loads of young people who would, you know, just want to be around Jane and these celebrities and doing work on clean water campaigns, doing work on solar energy, doing all this progressive work. He said, but on the other hand, if the reason they're doing it is because they're worshiping a celebrity, that's not the way you build a mass democratic movement. That's the way you put a single czar, czarina in power. And that's bad for democracy. So, you know, he kind of threw up his hands in the air and says it just cuts both ways.
And is it bad? So, for example, if Oprah acts as a kingmaker, which she somewhat did with President Obama, is this a bad thing for democracy? Or
no, I actually have a really strong opinion about that one. Oprah has been given short shrift. What Oprah said, and the polls, all these polls that ask people if celebrity X endorses that candidate, will it make you more likely to vote for them? Those polls, that's like, when did you stop beating your wife? It assumes you're an idiot. It assumes you're an idiot. I mean, because celebrity, I don't care who the celebrity or any politician or anyone, because they tell you to vote. The real question should be, will an endorsement from person A or B, celebrity X or Y, make you more likely to pay attention to the campaign, to pay attention to the issues of the campaign? That, to me, is a legitimate question. And what Oprah's endorsement did was get every study I've done about why is it that only 50% of the eligible electorate vote in presidential elections. And the League of Women Voters has done several of them, and they find that the bulk of people who don't vote are women. And when women are asked why they don't vote, they say, we don't understand the issues. And we don't want to vote if we really don't understand the issues. And why I thought Oprah's endorsement was so good, she didn't tell anyone to go vote for Obama. She said, I've never endorsed a candidate. I like Barack Obama. I think, you know, I just want to tell you, maybe you should pay attention to him. And what her endorsement did was reach into the 50% of the electorate that don't go and vote. And in this way, I think Oprah actually expanded democracy by increasing the amount of people voting. And various studies that have been done afterwards that do all these multiple regression analyses that I can't figure out how. But they argued that her endorsement got them an extra 1.2 million votes in the primaries. And when they broke it down, without that endorsement, Hillary would have been the candidate. And again, what Oprah did, whether you like Obama, don't like Obama, is she got people not used to voting to pay attention to a candidate and to the issues. And again, I just have to think in the long run, that's got to be good for this country, not bad for the country.
Let me, if I may.
Yes, go ahead.
One of your points was that women who don't understand the issues don't vote. I think, in fairness, you have to suggest that the problem is that men who don't understand the issues do vote.
I don't disagree. I'm just taking the Oprah point of view here.
There should be a male Oprah show.
Well, I mean, obviously there's only one woman on your 10 list, which is not a criticism of you, but
there's only one woman who was as active as the 9 other men, and I knew that would come up. But in the end, I thought it was more important to write about people I thought made a difference than to try to be politically correct and get the balance. Mm-hmm.
But today, I mean, you know, you could make the case for a devolution of the left and right into single-issue politics. And there are a number of women like Laurie David who are interested, you know, very active politically on environmental issues and so on. So there are more women at least on the left. You know, whatever you think of her politics, Susan Sarandon, Laurie David, I suppose, in an indirect and probably...
Well, yes, and the point well taken, and I list a whole bunch, as you know, of people on the left and right that deserve studies. But I was also interested in not just getting five left, five right, but to get people who did different kinds of political activism. Because we think that, you know, being politically active is, you know, either you run for office or you talk about an issue. And those are the two most common forms, electoral politics and issue-oriented politics. But I also wanted to talk about visual politics of people like Charlie Chaplin, who didn't like joining groups, who didn't want to be part of any organization. But because he was his own producer, writer, director, star, and later distributor, he had no studio head to tell him what he could or couldn't do. And so he preferred to put his politics directly on the screen. And I also found that you had a number of stars I write about who did the same thing. Once you had the end of the studio system in 1948 and movie stars opening their own production companies, people like Harry Belafonte opened his own production company and made two films. You had Jane Fonda opening up her own production company and making several political movies, films like Coming Home, films like The China Syndrome, that were dealing with the same issues CED was dealing with, her mass movement with Tom Hayden, off the screen. You had Warren Beatty opening his own company and making political films. Surprisingly, I didn't see many people, there may be, but I'm not aware of prominent people on the right who opened their own production companies to make political films to do their own ideas.
That was actually my next question, and for Roger too. I mean, unless I'm mistaken about this, I don't see too many people on the right reaching out to grassroots movements, for example, the Tea Party.
And there's been actually a fair amount of talk about that lately, that I've heard. I mean, whether it will emerge is another question. But they certainly are aware of what Steve's saying. So I think there probably will be. First of all, the whole movie industry is fracturing anyway. So it has fractured. I mean, so it's not... I mean, the studio system died ages ago, but the systems that replaced it are now fracturing. So the whole method of production is fractured, and I think what we're going to have is many, many different of schools of thought contending in the old Maoist phrase, and I'm sure some of them are going to be Tea Party-ish, because there have been a lot of talk about making movies about Franklin and so forth, and it's going to happen. I don't know.
They're picking the wrong guy if they pick Benjamin Franklin, let me tell you.
Well, he's an interesting character. No, they, you know, I think it's, there are all kinds of complex people from that.
If a movie that springs out of the Tea Party movement carries the theme, keep your government hands off my Medicare, I think they're in big trouble.
I think it'll be much more... It won't be that at all.
But is there sympathy for the Tea Party on the Hollywood right?
What's that?
Is there sympathy for the Tea Party on the Hollywood right, or do they see themselves largely as Republicans who are...
No, I think... I don't know the answer to that question, really, because, you know, the argument of the Tea Party is largely it's just a small government argument. I mean, that's basically what it is. The other stuff is... doesn't really exist. I mean, the racist attack on the Tea Party never held because it wasn't true. They weren't. They were small government people, and they are small government people. So that's a very different kind of argument, and how that will translate into reduction of film and television is hard to predict. I mean, it's, you know, there was a very failed and terrible movie of Atlas Shrugged that came out last year.
But if we're having an argument... Sorry.
Atlas Shrugged. There was a terrible movie version.
The Ayn Rand.
Yes, terribly made.
Start with a terrible book, you end up with a terrible book.
Well, you know, actually, I have to admit I've never read the book, so I don't, but I did see the movie. I was very bored. But you know...
And I was bored, too.
Well, that's good for you. But anyway...
I mean, nonetheless, if we're having public debates about personhood and what counts as a person, we're talking about a pretty extreme divide, you know, culturally, ideologically, and so on. It's not, you know, we're not. That's not a politically centrist debate.
What's that centrist debate between small government?
The idea of how to define what personhood is, which has come up in the last few days. I mean, I don't want to get into an argument about abortion and so on, but it suggests really a politically fractured country.
Yeah, well, actually, the Tea Party people that I've met, almost none of them talk about social issues. There are some who do, obviously, but the ones I've met are all interested in small government, lower, you know, less government involvement in everything. But they don't talk about abortion and they don't talk about gay marriage. They don't talk about it. That's not an issue that attracts their attention. They're all toward the economic issues. They don't. I've never heard them talk about it. No, I don't know how that. The thing about the economic issues of when they're theoretical, like the Tea Party argument is a theoretical argument. Will society work better for people if the government is less involved in it? Okay, that's a theoretical question that the answer to is hard to say, and so it's a very hard thing to dramatize in a movie. It doesn't easily. You could do a science fiction movie of, well, what happens if the government is less involved? All right, you know, is it Nirvana or is it Mad Max? You know, I two different ways to look at it. But I don't.
All I can tell you is, driving down Wilshire or Beverly Glen, I wish there was a bigger government that could fill the potholes.
Amongst other things,
yeah. Ella, we should turn it over to questions after maybe one more among you, if you wish her.
Okay, I just have one more question then, which is the subtitle of your book, which is called Blacklisting Myself, and its subtitle, unless I'm mistaken, is A Hollywood Apostate in an Age of... Apostate...
Whatever. The American version, I guess.
Okay, In an Age of Terror. What do you mean by terror, and what do you mean by apostate?
I was an apostate, or as we say in America, because I was formerly on the left and have moved.
Right.
I mean, that's an apostate, someone who, you know, was once a Muslim and then said he wasn't and got beheaded or whatever. That's an apostate. So I feel like I'm an apostate. You know.
When you talk about terror, are you talking about
post-9/11.
The threat from Sean Penn or the threat from Al Qaeda?
Okay, right. I don't know Sean Penn and I don't know Al Qaeda, but it was a reference to post 9/11. You know.
Okay, let's open up for questions from the audience. I think the mics are coming down to you here. Yes.
Thank you for a very interesting discussion, Mike. I'm 1,000% with you on abolishing the death penalty. Stephen, in the course of researching your book, did you deal at all with Ronald Reagan and his approach to nuclear disarmament after seeing The Day After and how that affected him and in his dealings with Gorbachev in Reykjavik?
No, because one of the, where I had to cut off, this book goes 500 pages, and I figured that was heavy enough. The moment somebody got elected to office, that's when basically my research ended, because then they were politicians, not movie stars. But I know there's stuff that he got confused and that the movies became his reality, but I can't really talk about it because all I know is general things. I never really researched it.
Just behind, the one down here in the sweatshirt with the hood. A hoodie. Yeah.
With people or the media covering and talking about people more and more voting on who they like or who they feel comfortable with as opposed to issues, isn't there another aspect of a celebrity running for office that you end up voting for him because of the role he played in a film or your comfort with it coming into your living room? Is that not an issue also as part of Hollywood left and right?
Yes. No, I actually write about that. In 1964, George Murphy, who you may remember as a song and dance man whose most famous role was Dancing with Shirley Temple, the kind of roles, and I write about that, the kind of roles you play, if you're a movie star, left or right, and you're thinking about a serious career in politics, then be very careful, because the kind of roles you choose are going to have a great impact on how the public perceives you. And in 64, when Murphy ran against Pierre Salinger, who had been the press secretary for the Camelot years, John Kennedy, everyone expected that he was going to lose dramatically to Salinger. And one of the TV stations, and clearly must have been democratically owned, began running his late-night movies, began running his movies on late-night television, thinking that people would see this, they would remember he's only a song and dance man, and they would become disgusted and say, how could he possibly be U.S. Senator, even though he had been the head of the California GOP for 2 years, media advisor to Eisenhower and Tom Dewey, and it backfired. And Murphy said to the press later on, he said, you know, I know why they did this. They thought they were going to smear me. But now I can go around and people say, oh, you're so nice. I remember you. Those movies bring back. You were the lovely young man who danced with Shirley Temple. And you were the best friend in this movie and in that movie. And he would then start going campaigning and say, I've been in more of your bedrooms than any other candidate in America. So, yes, those roles do help.
So does charm, I guess, yeah.
Right over here.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Two questions over here. Mike Farrell, I counted the words. I think there are 11. What story did MASH tell that is no longer being told on TV?
War hurts. Blood is not spilled without cost.
Eight words in answer. Yeah.
Mike, have you ever...
Where are you?
Over here.
Oh, sorry.
Have you ever been tempted to run for office, and do you feel you can be more effective as an activist versus a politician?
Tempted is a different word, was a line I said in the MASH one time. No, I'm not interested in running for office. I have been asked. I think that my role in society is one that's a personal one, and I think I have great, great respect for the people, the few among them in the political world that I consider public servants. But it's more of a sacrifice, and I'm not talking about economic. It's more of a sacrifice than I'm willing to make. I have a family, and they mean more to me than. As who was it? Walter Mondale said, "Spending all those nights in Holiday Inns."
I'm deeply concerned about the Republicans' attack on the woman's right to choose, and I'm curious as to why we have not seen more female stars come out in support of a woman's right to choose.
Seems to me we have, no?
You haven't, evidently. as far as I know, the women of this country are significantly engaged in this question. Let me just say, though, that I think things are coming at us in scattershot kind of bursts, and you have to sort of pick your fight. Whether you're concerned about abortion or whether you're concerned about racial issues or whether you're concerned about the economic disparity in this country or whether you're concerned about homelessness or whether you're concerned about whatever else is now in the consciousness. While, as Steve pointed out, Congress is voting on whether or not In God We Trust is still the motto of the United States of America. People are very, very confused today, and I think very upset at the way things are going, but there is a great deal of disarray in terms of figuring out how to respond to it.
Hi. I was wondering if maybe all three of you could comment on Jon Stewart's impact on political culture in this country. Because it seems to me that he's emblematic of what you were talking about earlier about a celebrity bringing attention to the issues and why you think he's been so effective at being someone who's obviously liberal-leaning, but opening up the conversation and garnering attention and respect from both sides of the aisle.
Who's?
John Stewart.
John Stewart.
Oh, John.
Anyone wanna?
Well, I think he's quite brilliant, and I think you're right. He tries to, I think he tries to be fair, and people have been so deluged with ideology that comes at them in the form of news and comes at them in the form of opinion and comes at them in the form of what have you, or what one thing or another. And much of it is simply dishonest. And what you get, I think, from John Stewart is a sense that he is an engaged, interested, intelligent American who is very worried about what's going on in this country and lets it be known. He's also very funny and very talented.
Yeah, I would say that John Stewart is the Jonathan Swift of our generation, and that part of his effectiveness is satire, that it is always easier to take your politics when you're laughing than when you have talking heads coming at you in an angry manner. And that the other thing about Stewart, I think one of the reasons he's popular is he's willing to poke fun at the left as well as the right, at the Democrats as well as Republicans. He will call a fool a fool. And all he has to do is show you the videotape that, you know, is the best things he does is, you know, I don't believe in this, I never have. And then he shows you something you said last, that candidate said last year, that politician said, that was 180 degrees. And so he exposes political hypocrisy on a daily basis. And if you look at the history, certainly the history of Hollywood, even during the censorship days of the early 30s, comedies were always less prone to be censored than dramas because nobody took comedians very seriously, did they? And that's why Jon Stewart can get away with so much, because he's doing it through humor. And yet we know there's intelligence, there's homework, there's preparation. And he isn't, even though it's clear Jon Stewart leans leftward, he is not afraid at any time to just go after anyone who's been a fool.
Roger.
I agree about Stewart. I think one of the interesting things about right now is that it's much more popular to get the news. More people get their news through Stewart and Colbert than they do through normal channels now. Now, there's a good thing in that, and of course there's a bad thing in that. And the good thing is that it's entertaining, that, as Steve says, he's willing to go against both sides, which is great. And it also makes him more entertaining because it makes him more authentic. On the other hand, it says something about our discourse that it's come to that. So there's a double side to it, and this is not to condemn Stewart. This is to condemn the rest. I mean, Stewart's doing what he's supposed to.
Okay.
Hi, I wanted to ask the panelist who's disillusioned because of Michael Moore, what will it take to become disillusioned with these right-wing wackos on Fox and some of these people that are running for office?
I'm disillusioned with them too. I mean, that's not a... I'm an equal opportunity disillusioned person.
What's that?
This is not going to win the contest with eight words. But I have two questions. I'll try to put them into one. It's a broad question. When you say the Hollywood right had power, what? I don't understand exactly what you meant. I equate power with control, influence. And certainly as the years have gone by, the right has not had power. The left, the very causes that the left espoused from the early 30s on came to be. Social Security, unemployment, even the war, Hollywood right opposed. They favored McCarthyism. That was exposed and discredited. And in view of the fact that, as you say, Hollywood had all this power, why did the country slowly turn to many of the issues that were hardly fought by the left came to being. Discrimination, equal rights for the blacks, equal rights for women, Social Security, unemployment insurance. I can go on and on.
Well, how about we let the panel answer then in that case? Anyone? Steve?
That was directed to Steve.
Yeah, I would say if you buy my book. it's a long answer. The short answer to that is you're not wrong, but you're sort of, maybe I've not made myself clear. I'm not saying everyone on the Hollywood right has done that, but there are two things to look at. One is, if you take the big picture of American politics in the 20th century, and you're asking a big picture question, there have been two, what I would say, foundational moments in 20th century politics that has affected all our lives. The first is the creation of the New Deal state, a welfare state with the social safety net under Franklin D. Roosevelt, president deeply supported by Hollywood, in fact, helped spark the emergence of Hollywood as a political center on the left. And the second is the attempt to dismantle the New Deal state with a conservative revolution begun under a movie star, Ronald Reagan, in 1980. But in between, you know, that isn't to say that the Hollywood left hasn't had a huge impact as well. And as Mike's pointed out, they've dealt mainly with issues that if you look at the 1930s and 40s, it's the Hollywood left that was out on the forefront promoting anti-fascism and anti-Nazism. In the 50s and 60s, it was the Hollywood left promoting the civil rights movement. In the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 2000s, it's been the Hollywood left leading the anti-war movement, and it's been many of the Hollywood left talking about socially progressive causes like a woman's right to her own body and other issues. But those are, again, those are important issues. Those are segments, and that's not to say the left hasn't had an impact. But if I'm talking about seismic changes, to me, the New Deal state and the conservative revolution of the 80s are the two biggest seismic changes in American politics in the 20th century.
We have time for one more quick question.
Hi. The quick question involves jobs. Hollywood, whether it's right or left, it's more corporate or not, and it's a star system where the stars will work, whether it's Louisiana or Michigan. What happened to the support of the unions and jobs here in California? There's also a tax issue, a tax credit issue. California is not competitive at all. So left or right, isn't it more corporate versus union?
Yes.
Sure.
It's the money-making business. That's the bottom line.
Sure.
And wherever they're going to make a profit, it's a business. You know, I can tell you, Ella teaches at the film school. I have even though I'm in the history department, I have a lot of PhD students from cinema. And they would tell me that in the undergraduates as well, in their first day, they are told, if you want to make art films, go to NYU. If you want to make a living, come to USC. They are under no illusion when they are trained there that you're being trained for a business and that the business is about making films and the business is about making money on those films. And so if going to Vancouver or Toronto or Louisiana gets you a tax credit that makes it cheaper, that's where you're going to go. And you can read stuff if you want to read really interesting stuff. Read Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee's collective autobiography, where they talk about going to Hollywood, Ruby Dee for the first time in the late 40s to make No Way Out, and not seeing a single black person below the line. Not a single black worker in Hollywood below the line. So there's never been much of a concern for below the line within the industry. And it's, again, when you look at Hollywood, you got to make a distinction between what I would call corporate Hollywood and creative Hollywood. Today we've been talking about creative Hollywood, but make no illusion, corporate Hollywood runs this town.
Well, if I can just add to that.
Sorry.
I came up in the business at a time when, Steve just made me think of it, as I always thought of it, there was a partnership between the creative and the business people, the corporate and the talent. And the difference today is that the corporate thinks they are the talent.
And indeed, sometimes they are. I mean, I just showed my students the Social Network today. You know, it's definitely a film that was made and distributed by a corporation. It's probably one of the best films of the last decade. So even that is kind of a difficult area, I think. Mm. I just want to thank all of you for coming tonight, and also to urge you to help support the Library Foundation, but in particular to thank our panelists for coming tonight. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.